History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario, a snowy nation's capital. We're recording this a week before we're posting it, so I think it's the 27th. Today.
It is the
27th. So, yeah, we had a big snowstorm overnight. I think it stopped now.
Just about.
So, there's only been a couple, I've only seen a couple things on Twitter about OC Transpo buses jackknifing and heading off into the ditch. So, could have been a lot worse. But traffic was snarled a little bit this morning. The nation's capital is white as we enter the Christmas season, the holiday season, which means Christmas parties and having to talk to people who you probably don't know. And having to explain exactly what it is that you do for a living. And I don't know about everyone else, but I generally have difficulty keeping people interested in the fact that I study history for a living. So today's podcast isn't so much our normal style of the podcast where we're going to engage in deep and thoughtful discussion. We're going to provide you with some anecdotes, some stories that if you want to take from us and tell at these sorts of parties, please feel free. We're gonna tell some of our favorite historical anecdotes, but I can't do this by myself. So for the first time ever in the history of the podcast, we're bringing in a co-host, the voice you just heard a few seconds ago, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Aaron Boyes. Welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me here. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. So this one, you're not a guest on this one.
No. I've been on a couple times, but first time as co-host. That's quite an honor.
Yeah. It's definitely gonna go to the top of the CV.
I plan on telling everyone. I mean, as soon as I get home, I'm going to be texting, I was going to say tweeting, but I'm not on Twitter, but Facebooking, emailing, you name it, everyone that I know to check out this episode.
Yeah, you might want to tattoo that, too.
Maybe on my forehead?
Yeah. Co-host, put the date.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
There's zero downside to that.
No. What kind of royalties would I get out of that?
Well, you'll have to get the same royalties that I get from the show.
Oh, but then I have to do it.
Naturally. So I don't know. Now, have you had the same experience as I have? You meet somebody at a party who doesn't really study history at all, isn't really interested in history that much. They ask you what you do, and you can see the eyes glaze over.
Well, I always feel bad, actually. I have a lot of people ask me, so what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Ottawa. And they say, oh, okay, that's really cool. And I'll say, yeah, I enjoy that. And they say, so what do you study? And I understand that they're being polite and that they're trying to engage in a conversation. But I always feel bad because I'm interested in my own topic, but I don't think anyone else out there, except for maybe one or two people, are actually interested in it as well. So I kind of try to think of the most generic way of describing what it is that I do. Mm-hmm. And then, so most of the time I just say, well, I study Canadian-American relations in the late 19th century. And a lot of people will just, that's more than enough information for them. And they just walk away. And I'm like, okay, let's move on to talking about something else here. But every so often someone will say, oh, really? What specifically?
Yeah.
And then I have to try to explain that I'm looking at the political union movement and what annexationism is. And that's where it gets tricky. And then I see the eyes kind of glaze over.
Yeah.
But other times, yeah, they say, so what do you do? And oftentimes, of course, like you can attest to, I sit in an archive and I sit in front of a microfilm machine for 8 hours and watch pages go by, and I tick the seconds away of my life just passing them by. So it's really not the most exciting thing to tell people.
Right. And the thing that I get a lot is that people, well, there's two things. One, if I say I do the CBC, if it gets that far, as they say, well, what do you study? It usually doesn't. They just say, what do you do? And I say PhD in history, and that generally is the end of it. But if they say, what exactly do you do? And I say the CBC, it's usually followed up by them either telling me how much they hate the CBC or love the CBC.
Well, I do that to you all the time.
And then it's followed up by a discussion. They want to talk about a specific TV program on the CBC.
Yeah.
And generally, I don't watch CBC TV, so I'm not really able to engage in that. And so that's kind of difficult to really get to that. Right?
Like, no, absolutely.
To really engage on, Because they're trying to be nice, and sometimes the interest is genuine.
Oh, there's no doubt, and I should probably clarify some of my comments there. You're absolutely right. Some people ask me what it is that I'm doing, and you can tell that their interest is really there and really genuine. And they say, "Well, I'm looking at this," and they say, "Oh, that's really cool because I know about this, that, and the other thing." Yeah. And it may even be 50 years later. Oftentimes, it kind of says, "Well, I've heard about there's times where the United States wanted to grab Canada like that. Is that the same kind of thing?" I say, "Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm doing." And it's really interesting to hear those reactions. Mm-hmm.
And you probably get it more often too, though, because you have to go to parties that aren't really yours because you have somebody who you will soon be related to by marriage.
That's right.
Who has her own work parties and her own set of friends on that side.
Yes.
That now you've had to, that you have to socialize with.
I do indeed.
So yeah. whereas for me, a lot of my friends are history-related people. I do have some folks outside of it, but for the most part, like if I'm going to a Christmas party this year, it's a history department Christmas party.
Yeah, so you're able to, so everyone knows what it is essentially, or even if they don't know what topic you are doing, I mean, history is actually a good commonality to attach to.
Right, I'm not going to the Hart Institute Christmas party.
No.
Which you are.
Which I will be, yes.
Right. So the situation is different there, that you have to come up with more general discussion.
Oh, absolutely. Again, because I can't just sit there and say, or stand there and say, yeah, I sat in front of a microfilm machine for 8 hours.
Right.
And a lot of people even say, well, what's a microfilm?
Right.
I mean, it's even at that point where it's just like, whoa, okay, now I've got to explain what a microfilm is and then go on and say I looked at newspapers that are over 100 years old, and even I'm not interested in talking about it, so I can't even imagine what a non-history person would think about hearing, that sounds fantastic, sitting in front of a big box and looking at microfilms all day.
Mm. Now, anecdotes. We have a bunch here that we want to say. We have some guests coming up in a little bit. So
yeah, looking forward to hear what they have to say as well.
Yeah, it'll be good. I'm curious as to what they're going to say.
Yeah.
Based on their emails to me, they have some good stuff for us. So
perfect.
So first off, we're going to tell our favorite ones. So first off, you have a good Sir John A. Macdonald story.
I do. Well, more so because John A. Macdonald is one of those universal figures in Canadian history, in the sense that everyone knows about him, even if no one knows a lot about history. They know who Sir John A. Macdonald was. So if I was at a party and I was talking about history and all that, I may share this story because, again, John A. Macdonald is just that recognizable name. And part of John A. and his charm, I guess, if you will, was his public drunkenness. And so if you're at a party and you're having a few beverages and you're just enjoying the atmosphere, it'd be nice to relate this story. Now, there's so many tales about Sir John A. Macdonald's drinking. Now, of course, some people have said that it was a problem. Others said it's just a thing of the time and so that everyone was drinking. But Macdonald's penchant for drinking was really quite clear, even during his own time. And what I love about it is that he was the first person to make fun of it, or he would be the first person to engage that he was drunk. I've got a couple of things here that I've gleaned from a couple of sources that I was kind of reading through. I looked it up a little bit because I want to make sure about this. And there's this one tale where John A. Macdonald was on a campaign and he arrived for a debate, but he was so drunk that when he took to the platform after his opponent had finished speaking, he quickly threw up. So there's Macdonald. He throws up on stage, wipes his mouth, and then smiles, and he says, and I quote, "Every time I hear this liberal speak, it turns my stomach."
That's outstanding.
And the crowd went nuts.
Oh, how good is that?
The crowd just went nuts. And I read this, and I just thought, I have to tell this little story, because I was howling with laughter as I'm reading this.
That's so good.
Like, I can't even imagine a politician having the guts to do that now.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not, of course, showing up drunk anywhere, but making light of that situation. Well,
we have politicians who are in
there. Well, yeah. But anyway, I thought that was just outstanding.
That's really good.
So, and then, of course...
Well, but then you wonder if he threw up because he was drunk, or he maybe timed it. Like, is he just lucky in having perfect timing like that?
I don't know, but... No, he may have timed it. I mean,
do you think maybe he could do that on command? So I've heard people can do that.
He was pretty politically savvy. I mean, the man was brilliant when it came to politics and winning a crowd. So it might have been on purpose.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Absolutely outstanding.
Could you imagine if that happened in a YouTube world?
Oh, that would go viral.
Like so fast, and not just the viral video of it itself. There would be like the remixes to it, and people would cut things around it.
And then the mocks of them, like people doing it on their own and trying to recreate it. And
it would be unbelievable.
It would be a sensation. It'd be a phenomenon.
Oh,
like,
it'd be great.
Like nothing else.
Oh, it'd be great.
Hundreds of millions of hits. There's no doubt about it. So that's what I mean. One of those things that I feel as though you could at a party, you could just kind of tell those
story.
Things.
That's a good story.
Yeah, and I mean. Again, you don't need to know very much about who he was as a politician. You really don't even need to know too much about what he was like a man or as a man. But just knowing that this character, this great personality, had this little soft spot for the drink, and then you can relate this little tale. And what I feel so helps to break the ice.
That's a good story. That's a good story.
Well, thanks. I'm glad I was able to.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
So now I have to tell it, like, you're gonna start with that?
You're gonna have to follow. Hey,
you're gonna lead with that?
Hey, I'm co-hosting this. I mean, there's no way that I'm gonna try to steal the spotlight.
Well, you know, I still have the producer on my side.
Yes, that is true.
Although I want to fire him really bad.
Well, he's pretty terrible.
He's the worst producer ever. So the one I like to tell, that my go-to, is a William Henry Harrison story. Partly because he's a very little-known figure. Although he does get a shout out in the Simpsons episode, the President's
and we've
there.
Talked about that numerous times. It is so brilliant.
So William Henry Harrison, he was the president for about a month, and what had happened was William Henry Harrison was an older gentleman when he won the American presidential election, and he was a great orator. He really liked to give speeches and long speeches. So when he was during his inauguration held in. January. And Washington, D.C., it's not the coldest place in the world, but it tends to get a little chilly.
Absolutely.
And William Henry Harrison was hell-bent on giving a great inaugural address. It's going to be one of those speeches that just goes down in American history. Everyone remembers it. Great speech. It's going to be quoted forever. And he goes on for about 2 hours. And it just so happens that while he's doing so, or in the immediate aftermath, he gets pneumonia. And he dies from his speech. And nobody really remembers the speech. So probably because he died. I mean, maybe the speech would be more famous if he didn't die. But he died.
Yeah, his death outdid his speech. His big, grand inaugural speech.
But nobody remembers. Like, nobody really remembers him. I mean, I've taken however many American history courses that cover the 19th century. And it's come up in one. He's made an appearance in one.
Wow.
One of the courses.
I'm surprised he even made it in one.
Yeah. Not only
except
that,
as a passing footnote, maybe.
No, not only that. He got a half hour of policy discussion of William Henry Harrison's policy.
For his 30-day presidency.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So there you go. So William Henry Harrison. That's my go-to, usually. And then because I can tie that into the Simpsons episode. Because the line, it's the song about lesser-known presidents.
Again, that's one of those things that for avid watchers of the Simpsons, they will hear that line and think, oh, hey, I know William Henry Harrison. I don't know why I know him, but hey, he was a guy that died, right? And
So those are our sort of stories of things that happened in the past that we like to tell. Now, some people also want to hear about exactly what it is we do, an archive story. So I think everyone who studied history at a graduate level, at least, has at least one archive story.
Oh, yeah.
That they can tell. So, and yours actually just happened, or one of yours just happened recently.
Yeah, one of the more memorable ones, and not just because it just happened recently, but I was down in Toronto a couple weeks back on a research trip. There was a couple archival film that I needed to look at the University of Toronto and at the Archives of Ontario at York University, which, by the way, for any listeners out there, if you need an excuse to go visit the Archives of Ontario, find it.
Yeah.
It is an absolutely beautiful building. It is a great place to go. It's just a fantastic archive.
Yeah.
So there's my little plug for the Archives of Ontario. But my personal tale takes place down at the University of Toronto. And I was going to the Thomas Fisher Rare Book Library, where a specific phone was located. And I was very, very eager to get there. So I got to the archives right at 9 o'clock. I knew I was going to have a lot of work to do. So I got there quite early, wasted a bit of time, finally got in there, really excited, ordered the materials, and the receptionist told me, okay, so that material will be ready for you at 10:30. It was 9:15. And I didn't bring anything with me. I thought I took it for granted that I'd be able to just show up and have access to this material right away. So I thought to myself, this is not good. Yeah. How am I going to waste an hour and 15 minutes in order to get to this material? Now, luckily, there was a professor down at the University of Toronto who I will not name his name specifically, but here's a shout out. If you're listening, you know who you are. Thanks again very much.
Such a shill.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to on this one. But so I sent him a quick message to see if he was available to get a cup of coffee. We had been exchanging emails for quite some time. And I thought, he's busy at work. He probably doesn't have time. I thought, you know, I'm really catching you off guard. And I got the message back saying, sure, I'm on my way down. I thought, this is incredible. So about 5 minutes later, he comes down. We introduce ourselves for the first time. And immediately my first thought is, this is a great guy right here. I mean, I had already knew that from the emails that we exchanged back and forth. He was being really, really helpful. And long story short, essentially, I thought maybe 20 minutes I'd be able to say, hey, thanks very much. Not really no going there. Next thing I know, we talked for an hour and a half. We were chatting about his dissertation and mine and how they were really similar to one another. And he was giving me some great ideas. He helped me out with a bunch of things. And it was just amazing. And I felt as though this is not your typical visit down to the archives. I mean, this is something special here when you actually sit down with someone and talk history and someone who's really engaged with it as well. So yeah, that was just outstanding. And then it was 11 o'clock. My material was there and I got to spend the rest of the day at the University of Toronto at the Rare Book Library down there. And it was just great. Just a wonderful experience.
And before you get too ahead of yourself, you're already engaged.
No. I am. That is
the way you're talking about it.
Yes, I know. And I told him that too. I said, I'm gushing over you, man. I mean, I don't know what to say. Total man crush right there.
Well, that's fine. I mean, it's nice when you meet somebody who is interested in what you do and you guys could relate to the topic that you were talking about, that you're down there to research, and who's really nice about it. And who you can engage with in that, because that doesn't happen all that often.
No, exactly.
Not that people aren't nice, but that people who study similar things and you have a chance to sit for an hour and a half uninterrupted and just talk about it. That doesn't happen often.
No, and it was just like this. It was just a conversation. It wasn't forced. It wasn't anything. It was just a great exchange of ideas and a great conversation. It was just, it was awesome.
Yeah. So there's a very positive archive experience. I have a very negative archive experience. Now, this one didn't happen to me. And actually, I just heard this story yesterday from Patrick Pollock, who's just finished his PhD here. And he's now a sessional. And he studies, or the talk yesterday was about Polish communists in Canada from the 20s to the 50s. And he told a story that before the Second World War, the commissioners, or the representatives, the Polish diplomats were all changed out. So the ones who were here before had hid a bunch of documents pertaining to their communist efforts in Canada. And they hid them away in the consulate, marked them all as confidential, hid them away. And it wasn't until 2002 that a maintenance person at the consulate found these boxes. And the consulate was in Sandy Hill. And if you know Ottawa at all, Sandy Hill is also where the University of Ottawa is. So Patrick lived in Sandy Hill and the consulate's in Sandy Hill. And I think everyone, there's an idea, and I had this before I moved to Ottawa, that these embassies and consulates were grand places.
That's what I thought when I first moved here.
For the most part, they're not. They're just sort of old houses. I mean, I live two doors down from the Greek embassy. And if you're living in my neighborhood, you're not in some great place, right? So it's just like an old house that was converted into offices for the consulate. So this main guy found this stuff, and there was a story in the paper about it. So Patrick got very excited, knowing that these documents were available, or at least had been found, and they pertained to what he was interested in. So he thought, wow, great stuff in Ottawa that speaks specifically to Polish communism. Before he could access those, of course, the Polish government had to declassify any of the documents. So these documents were actually sent to Warsaw. Declassified and put in the Polish archives in Warsaw.
No.
So for Patrick to find or to reference the documents that were found roughly 5 minutes from his house, he had to travel to Warsaw.
Oh.
Yeah. That's kind of a downer.
That's... Oh.
Yeah. So there you go.
And it's not like trying to go, or if you have to go to a foreign country, it's not like hopping over the border here and going to the United States.
No.
I mean, you're, man, that, oh.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I guess you get a trip to Warsaw out of it.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, yeah, that's a good way of looking at it, but that's a long way to go to get things that are not even a kilometer from your house.
Yeah, it also took 2 years, too. So they were found, I think you said they were found in 2002, and it took 2 years for them to be declassified and made available to them.
Oh, man.
So we had to hang around knowing that they were available, or knowing that they'd been found, but not being able to reference them.
Man, yeah, that's
such a tease, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, look, our first guest is here.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And this segment is brought to you by Salad.
I'm totally using that as we welcome in James Morgan, our first guest. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you.
So you have a rather interesting past before getting into the academic history. You worked in radio for a long time.
I did. I was a combination freelance and salaried reporter and news announcer, and I did some work in print journalism for close to 6 years.
Give us your best radio voice.
Now that you put him on the spot,
I'll try it again. I think we had it.
Do you need something to read? You can read. I have something written down.
Is the weather report there or something?
I don't know. I don't know if that's any good.
Fans scream praise or outrage with little acknowledgement of a middle ground. It is not surprising that our prime ministers are prone to being misunderstood. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. That's not an apology for the prime minister. Past or present.
I love it. I love watching you present too, because you can tell, because you read your papers and sometimes you sort of go off script a little bit, and there's such a difference in your voice and the way you present.
That's what you,
it's
people
so
say.
Good. So much fun to watch.
I presented a paper not long ago at a conference in Montreal, and I had a couple of people say that to me, and it was, I guess I don't notice it.
It's great.
It's just what I'm used to.
I normally don't like watching people read papers, but it's brilliant to see.
Oh,
it's just so much fun.
That's good. Thanks.
All right. What do you got for us in terms of anecdotes? Because you have a bunch. So
many anecdotes. I was thinking about this before I came here, and a couple of days ago, and driving here in the car. You know, I think, you know, as historians, we use sources, both primary and secondary. And I think in a lot of ways, the journalist fabricates the source. And I don't mean fabricate in a false sense, hopefully.
pending legislation, here you go.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that a journalist in a lot of ways makes a source that ends up being very valuable to a historian later on, both primary and secondary sources. I think journalists are better at making a primary source. And looking back now, the years I spent in that business, I felt like I feel now like I was making primary sources that historians might use later on. Just through the places I worked, the people I encountered while I worked, and the types of stories I covered. Not many people can say that they're among the very few ever who, aside from qualified technicians and scientists, to ever be actually right inside a nuclear reactor. When I was working at a radio station in southwestern Ontario about 5 or 6 years ago, the Bruce Power facility on Lake Huron, the one entire plant was being refurbished. It was the first time ever a reactor has been sufficiently decontaminated to the level that the average person can go inside it. We basically all went in wearing, one-piece pajama suits. That got a lot of laughs. The only precaution was that the individual who let us, it was a group of local journalists, let us through, said, don't scratch your nose. So we were in there probably 10 or 15 minutes.
Wait. Why can't you scratch your nose?
Well,
like the inside of your nose or the outside of your
outside,
nose?
Just scratch the outside of your nose. And he said, because if there's anything on a particle on your finger or on your nose, that could, transmit it somehow. meanwhile, we were all just wearing these, paper pajama suits. It looked like a really cheaply made-for-TV science fiction movie, but it was interesting. I mean, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And there again, I was working mostly in small towns and rural areas, and people would think nothing happens there, where the only culture is agriculture, as I often like to say. some of the people I met, you go to a village of 2,100 people on a stormy Saturday night, late winter, and Stephen Lewis packs the high school gym. I interviewed him in the high school's library. A local organization sponsored him to come and speak. He was just finishing up his tenure as UN commissioner on HIV/AIDS. He joked that the last time he'd been to that same part of rural Ontario was when he was the provincial NDP leader in the 1970s, and being a very conservative area, he didn't get the reception back then that he was getting at that time. But, nobody would ever think that, as intelligent and as eloquent as Stephen Lewis would come to a small agricultural community.
Who's the favorite person that you've met?
Oh, there's a lot of favorites I have. I would
one.
Say
no fence it. We don't fence it on this show.
We don't fence it.
actually, we do it all the time.
Rules. There are so many. It wasn't even necessarily people themselves. Sometimes people who worked for other people were just as easy to get along with. I met so many politicians.
They're not interesting.
Well, some of them actually were, and some of them I found, regardless of their partisan affiliation, to be really decent people.
Mm-hmm.
There's ones, quite plainly, I'll say that I don't think we're very decent people.
You want to name names?
No, I don't think I'll name names today, but there are some individuals that, I think party affiliation means absolutely nothing in the merits of a person in politics. One more anecdote, though. I interviewed Peter Mansbridge.
Mm.
That's kind of scary when you are the one interviewing Peter Mansbridge.
Right.
It wasn't a particularly stressful topic or anything, but I was at an event in Stratford. The local historical society had an event for surviving war brides in the area. They had an event, there was tea, of course, tea and cake and dramatic presentations and singing and this kind of thing. And the MC for it was Peter Mansbridge, who actually lives in Stratford. And he had to leave right at the end, so I ran outside and talked to him on the step. He was in a hurry to get to the spring premiere of a play starring his wife, actress Cynthia Dale, at the Stratford Festival. And I found him to be very, very personable individual.
Even in that circumstance where he wants to leave, and you're not letting him.
Even in that circumstance, he had his younger son with him, and, they were eager to literally run up the hill. There's a soccer field below the festival theater. That's the thing that they don't show in Stratford. Behind it's just a municipal soccer field. Mm-hmm. He was in a hurry to run up the hill to see this play. I covered once it was opening night of the Stratford Festival, and the Ontario Coalition of Poverty bussed protesters out from Toronto to Stratford to try to crash the event. Mm-hmm. It was a near riot around the festival theater. And
I don't think of people going to see a play at Stratford as being the worst offenders of capitalism.
Their idea was that this is a place for rich people, rich, and especially opening night. Some of the people showing up at opening night are fairly well-off people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very surreal experience when you see protesters ready to attack the crowd or the lineup, phalanxes of riot police brought in from all over Ontario.
Remember what the play was?
No, I don't remember what the play was.
Because it'd be good if it was a play that had like some sort of a fight scene.
There's always sword fights in Shakespearean plays or something. So, these riot police, the protesters, and then I'm seeing in the same, walking up the sidewalk to go in, all dressed in their tuxedos and evening gowns, are, first is Bob Ray and his wife, and then right behind is Stephen Page. So it was a very strange experience.
That's a bit of an eclectic audience.
They were chatting together. I think they have some political similarities.
But then along those lines, then, James, if you can't pick the favorite person that you've interviewed, can you think about
your favorite story that you covered, one that specifically sticks out in your mind. I mean, you've told a couple here, but like one that just, when you think back to your journalistic career, just that it always jumps out, be it because it was an amazing event or it was hilarious or it was a goof up or something along those lines.
I think the ones I remember the most are probably the most unfortunate. I was in the very difficult position of covering the funeral of someone from my hometown who was in the army and was killed in Afghanistan. And it was someone I knew, and he was a friend of a friend, so I had, you know, seen him a few times. I knew who his family was, a town of 5,000 people, and you've lived there for a few years. It's pretty hard not to know. He was one of 13 children, too, so they were almost a town unto themselves. That was extremely difficult. I didn't want to give up the story and hand it off to somebody else. But that was just a miserable experience. The family wouldn't allow reporters to actually be in the church for the funeral service, which I think was good. We respectable individuals were all lined up in our cars in the pouring rain on the highway in front of the church, and inside there was a major news outlet that sent someone in just as a ordinary anonymous mourner and sat in the congregation and took notes the whole time, and it was in some of the larger papers the next day. That prompted a lot of... I was outraged by that. I thought it was so disrespectful. And I also, when I was working in eastern Ontario, I wasn't far from CFB Trenton, and I used to cover repatriation ceremonies there. Those stand out as the stories I hated to hear about. I mean, as soon as you came across the wire that someone was killed in Afghanistan, you know, oh no, here I go again. I'm going to end up out at the base in a couple of days. What upset me about that was the circus that would develop almost along the road at the entrance to the base. I know people were being respectful, trying to be respectful and patriotic, but, you know, when the door of an airplane opens up and a casket's carried out, I don't think the right thing for people to do is shout, you know, hooray, he's home, you know, and clap. It just didn't seem right. I mean, it's, you know, there's a son, there's a father, there's a, you know, in there, there's a family standing nearby that's lost someone. You'd get the story, and then you'd go back in the car and never left right, you know, started up right away to drive back. It was always, had a few minutes to try to recollect your emotions, I think, at least for me. Those ones stand out as the worst. Anything particularly funny, I think the funniest story.
There's the non-sequitur.
That's
right
the there. Worst transition ever.
It was a bad transition. But I'm not the producer. Anything, the funniest, I think, was the time I interviewed Oprah. No, not that Oprah. Not Oprah Winfrey. I'm not a big fan of her, so I wouldn't want to prove it. It probably wouldn't go well anyway. There was a farm animal organization, I forget the exact name of it, supposed to teach children about proper raising of livestock. And they had a talking doll made up called Oprah. And it was an acronym for something. It just turned out it was called Oprah, and I went to this event they had, and it was the lead story the next morning on the farm news, the station I was working with for at the time, and interviewed Oprah.
Nice.
She didn't look or sound anything like Oprah Winfrey. She wasn't near as wealthy. If she didn't have somebody behind the scenes, behind a curtain, talking into a microphone, she wouldn't have been able to communicate, so...
Did this other Oprah draw a big crowd as well, though?
I think there was about five or six of us.
Oh, okay. So it was a little smaller.
A little bit smaller.
A
little bit.
Yeah.
All right, James Morgan, you got to run. You're mentoring graduate students.
That's right. I have to head over to that office next.
So you got
to
take off. Thanks for doing this, bud.
You're welcome. It was fun.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Okay. So that was James. that transition was so... amazing.
I feel bad. I feel as though I'm partly responsible for that. I think with my question, what I tried to do is I tried to goad him into telling a funny story or something like that. And then
when he went in the reverse, in the opposite direction, I didn't know what to say. I kind of felt as though my question was stupid or it was a bad question to ask. And
that was brilliant. It was just brilliant. I love that. That was so funny. Okay, so here's another story that I like to tell, and it's a baseball related story because I've read a lot of baseball books. It's just something that I'm really interested in, and the history of baseball, the history of the sport. So we got a few ones, and I'll tell one about Frank Robinson, who was a legendary player for the Orioles. This is when he was with the Orioles. He was the team captain, one of the older guys on the team, and in baseball they do a kangaroo court. It depends on which team you're on, how often it happens, but basically if you do something dumb on the field, you're going to get fined by your teammates in the kangaroo court. Like if you have a base running error, or you drop a ball that you should catch, or something like that. Like something...
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
I might try to do that with my ultimate team.
It's a good idea.
I like it.
Yeah, we've done it. Actually, our curling team is doing it. It's not a kangaroo court because you can't defend yourself, but if you miss a shot, you have to pay a buck.
Huh.
And at the end of the year, we're going to buy dinner with it or something.
Oh, that's great.
So it's the same idea with baseball, but guys get a chance to defend themselves in the clubhouse. And people are fine, and then the money is used for something at the end. But this particular year in Baltimore, the Orioles hired a new clubhouse kid who didn't have any hands.
Really?
Yeah. Which a lot of the guys, based on sort of the story, is that a lot of the guys were uncomfortable around the clubhouse kid.
Huh.
Because he had hooks instead of
Yeah, I can hands. See how that'd be. Not knowing. Yeah, I could see
yeah.
that.
So, but the kid apparently was really good at his job and doing all the clubhouse things, but guys were a little uncomfortable, didn't know how to approach him. So the first time they were doing kangaroo court that year, Frank Robinson was leading it as the team captain. And the person came up, tried to defend themselves, and then you have to judge guilty or not guilty, and the rest of the team is the jury.
Huh.
So Frank Robinson says, all right, now it's time to vote. If he's guilty, thumbs up. If he's not guilty, thumbs down. And everyone votes. Frank Robinson immediately points to the kid with no hands and says, you are fined $10 for not voting. And at that point, everybody felt comfortable around the kid. They felt it was okay to joke around.
Oh, man, that is outstanding. Yeah. Oh, that is so good. And I can only imagine just the look on everyone's faces as he says that. Yeah. I mean,
but as soon as the kid starts laughing, you know that it's okay.
Oh, yeah.
It's a perfect way to approach that uncomfortable situation.
Oh, that is brilliant.
Just make a joke about it. So there you go.
Yeah, hey, that's sometimes the easiest way of doing it. It's just making light of it a little bit, and you're good to go.
Yeah. So you want to bring guest number two?
Yeah, that sounds a great idea.
All right. Okay, guest number two, Madeline Klosky, who is not here, unfortunately, but she joins us via the Skype. Madeline, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing good, thanks. So you are really, really far away. Couldn't make it in because of distance reasons, right?
Yes, the distance of approximately 4 to 5 blocks.
Yes.
Well, I mean, and I'll put it out there to our listeners. We had a huge snowstorm here in Ottawa overnight, but I asked Madeline, it had nothing to do with the snow, so she assured me that it wasn't just because it snowed.
No, I'm Canadian. The snow doesn't stop.
Yeah,
you're from Vancouver Island. Knock it off.
You can't
talk about how you're okay with snow if you're from Vancouver Island. Give me a break.
Okay. Well, you've been here in Ottawa long enough to understand what kind of snow we get here.
Oh, yes.
You know what? If you're going to say that, you're integrated into Ontario, Quebec weather, you have to be okay with thunderstorms.
Yeah, well, see, that's where I fall short.
You know, so until you get to that point where you're used to thunder, I'm not going to give you a pass on saying you're okay with snow.
Okay, well, fair. I'll keep you updated on the
thunderstorms. Yes. Please do. All right, so you got a couple of good stories for us here. First one is something you found in the archives, right?
Yeah, something that, whenever I'm telling people about what I do, I sort of like to pick out some of the more quirkier things, which are usually the things that I come across when you're sort of following branch after branch and your research takes you far, far off the main path. And one of the things I came across earlier this year, I was looking at papers from Robert Borden and another minister from the First World War, Thomas White, and deep down in the depths of those papers where things weren't super relevant to what I was doing, found a series of correspondence, not between Prime Minister Borden, although it was with that sort of collection, between two ministers planning to sort of blackmail or leverage another minister, who was one I'd never heard of before, and to get him to basically support and vote the way they wanted by using his preference for underage women to sort of get his compliance with their plan. And that was something that was very interesting. I think I sort of read those letters for probably 30 or 40 minutes before I was like, all right, this isn't why I'm here.
Now, how detailed were these letters? Like, did they talk about exactly what they did? Like, were they going to go to the press, or were they going to...
They were going to threaten to go to the press. They had identified one of the underage women in question, and they had her being looked after. They had her name, and basically they were going to go confront this person and say that you need to do what we want, or we're going to basically make it known, and we have this girl basically under our wing to do what we want in terms of getting you to do what you are, what we want you to do. So it was very planned out. There was a lot of, you know, they were very careful. They didn't mention a lot of names, but the situation and intention was very clear.
That's interesting because because if you're not going to go, well, okay, one, I guess, how do these other ministers know that this is going on?
I imagine just like anywhere, there's a lot of sort of backroom, locker room chit-chat. Everybody knows everyone else's vices. His just happens to be one that is frowned upon. During this time, could have gotten into quite a bit of trouble, particularly after returning the war. This is a very, very moral superiority type of atmosphere. So that sort of thing really wouldn't have flown very well in the public eye. Not that it would have any other time, but... particularly during that period.
No, but I think if you have if that's your game, you're not gonna really be public about it, right? That's not something that you're gonna brag about in the locker room, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, I'm thinking of this, you know, this great show we've been watching lately, House of Cards, and one of the main character there, Kevin Spacey, what he does is he looks for things to leverage his fellow politicians. He searches that out in order to basically make it so they owe him something. And so I was sort of imagining, you know, World War One version of this, where people are scoping out all these, maybe the different vices of their peers, just so they can leverage them when required. I mean, there's a lot on the line during this period. You need to get people to do what you want.
Right. So they're probably following this guy around. Or
oh,
someone's following him.
I mean, it wasn't spelled out, but there had definitely been some type of recon going on. And, you know, I think that they sought out this girl, and once they realized her role and basically gave her what she needed at the time, which would have probably been, you know, money, lodging, things like that, and said, now tell us everything.
How do you have that conversation?
I'm telling you, you need to go watch House of Cards. It's still
yikes. All right. So there's one. Now, that one is somewhat...
it's a bit more risque.
Yeah, not necessarily the most uplifting of stories.
No, but it's one of those ones that I know, at least in my experience, whenever I'm talking to people about what I do, it's one I always mention since it happened, because people who, you know, are interested in history and what we actually do at the archives, I think finding those little kind of quirky or more... drama-based things is what they find sort of interesting. You know, it's not all boring snoring. It's, we actually do find some very interesting things.
Yeah, occasionally we can stumble upon something that's mildly...
I mean, I want to emphasize, it's not like that every day, but every once in a while you come across something really peculiar. And something like that, too, I think a lot of people look at the past as something, you know, very sterile, necessarily, so it's interesting to see things like that, because it's like, well, you know, not everybody was as gentlemanly and proper as we might think they were.
Right, that's one way to put it. All right, now, you got one more, and now this one, you and I'm pretty sure are going to disagree on the merits of the plan.
Well, another one of my favorite things that I've sort of come across is I'm looking at a lot of newspapers during the First World War for my research to sort of gauge public opinion in some areas. And one of the things that I've come across particularly from 1917 on, when resource shortages were more evident. And I believe this started off as a satire, but it sort of gained traction. And there's this whole series of letters that people have written into various editors in various newspapers and magazines that call in for basically the mass extermination of pets in Canada. So cats and dogs, because cats, of course, are drinking milk and other things, are eating meat, just like dogs are eating meat. And these are all things that are very scarce during the First World War. And since there's a lot of people who are sort of going without, it's this idea that why not get rid of an unnecessary use of these foods. And I think, like I mentioned at first, it sort of began as a satire, this idea, well, if we're doing all these extreme measures, why not do this one step further? But then it seems like some people sort of went, well, wait a minute, that's actually a good idea. Because I found
numerous
people coming forth with this idea or supporting this idea. So something we might kind of cringe at now, or maybe you wouldn't.
Nope.
No, he's actually sitting here smiling.
I'm all in on this idea.
I figured you might be. Sean's not the biggest cat fan in the world. I'm not sure about your feelings on dogs.
No, get him out.
As a cat lover, I found this to be quite interesting and equally horrifying. But it's something really different, again, that people don't expect. I didn't expect to find it, but when I came across it, it's something that's really stuck out to me. And it's another thing that I sort of mentioned to people, another quirk in Canada's past. Mm.
All right, Malin, we'll let you back to it, to your very important work that you're working on.
Oh, yes, it's exam season.
Yes. So now this is going to be posted after the actual exam is given, so do you want to give the people a little taste of one of your questions?
Oh, Sean, that would assume that I've done work on the exam.
Okay, fair enough. All right, I think that's a good way to end it.
Perfect.
Malin Klosky, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
All right, so that was fun.
That was great.
A little long-distance podcasting.
I love it.
And by long distance, I mean 4 blocks. So moving ahead now, we're going to look at, you know, historical anecdotes aren't always anecdotes. Sometimes you can get the quick hitters.
Oh, sometimes those are the best.
Yes. And arguably the best of all time is Winston Churchill?
I would say so.
Yeah. So which one's your favorite Churchill quote?
Well, there's a bunch of them out there, but I think one of the ones that just gets me is just the fact that Churchill's bravado and his penchant for just coming up with these great one-liners out of the blue. And I've got one here that I pulled up that just kills me every time. And it's Churchill saying, and I quote, "I may be drunk, miss, but in the morning I will be sober and you will still be ugly."
Oh, that's so good.
I would love to know what she said to him to make him say that to her.
Well, maybe she was just rude. Maybe she cut in line.
Maybe.
You know?
Maybe just,
it's
yeah.
So good. Oh, it's so good. Oh, man.
So, yeah, so that's the one that usually pops into my brain when I think about Churchill. But you got one, too.
Yeah, there's the one, I think it was Lady Astor, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
I couldn't confirm, I don't know.
They were in some sort of disagreement, and she said to him, "Sir, if you were my husband, I would poison your drink." And he looked at her and said, "And if you were my wife, I would drink it." You're like, bam, what is up?
Yeah, no, I feel bad a little bit there. I mean, those are two Churchill quotes that unfortunately take pot shots at our female audiences, our listeners here. And
I don't think they do. I think they take pot shots at those two specific individuals at whom they were aimed.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that it's not, we didn't pick those for any...
No.
Okay.
No, I think those are just the two, maybe even the most notable ones.
Yeah.
No, I don't think our female listeners will be offended.
Well, that's good. I just want to make sure about those. Because, I mean, yeah, those are just two of the ones that just kind of stick out. Of his more humorous quips. Yes. I mean, obviously, Churchill is known for his great eloquent speeches, especially during the Second World War, which you can quote ad nauseum, and people have done it in the past. But those ones seem to kind of, every time they pop up every so often, they always usually get a good laugh.
Yeah, they're good jokes. Hey, speaking of Britain, Nicklin!
Hey, buddy!
Nicklin's here, all right.
I'm doing pretty well, how are you?
Good, thanks for coming down.
Yeah, no problem.
In a big snowstorm.
Yeah, it was a little. It took a little extra time to fight my way here. So, I'm mostly through back streets, so it is kind of a bit of a trek.
Yeah. Have they plotted at least yet, or are they clear the sidewalks?
My street will probably be late afternoon at earliest. Like, it's the back street.
See, I'd like to point out to Sean Graham here that my streets out in Nepean were paved or were plowed this morning, even the sidewalks. And apparently, I live out in the middle of nowhere.
No, I didn't say you live. I don't. I've never said you live in the middle of nowhere. I said you don't live in Ottawa.
Well, the city of Ottawa plowed the streets and sidewalks.
Well, they plowed the suburbs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
so I just want to point that
because
out.
The suburban people get mad.
Oh, is that what it is?
Us urban folk.
Okay.
Are very tough, and we can handle it.
Well, we can bus. We can walk. I mean, people out there. If you can't drive,
you're screwed.
Yeah.
I took the bus in this morning.
Yeah, but it took you an hour and a half.
It did take me an hour and a half to get in, yes. That's very true.
You're a commuter.
I am.
So don't say that you live in the city, because you don't. The same reason the senators aren't really the Ottawa senators. They don't play on it.
Yeah.
You study civil aviation. One of my favorite shows is May Day, and so that's really the Lincoln.
Okay.
I love that stuff. Do you have any good plane crash stories?
Unfortunately, no. I kind of...
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Yes, we wish we had more plane crash stories.
Like, no, I've seen a few. I mean, some of the material that takes up the most space is plane crashes, but it's not really relevant to what I look at.
Right.
So I tend to kind of skip over. There are boxes and boxes that I've had to skip over because it wasn't the most relevant. But
right.
There's plenty of very important crashes that I just didn't look into all that much for my own work.
So you got some good archive stories for us.
Yeah. I figured probably the most interesting experience I've had with my research was when I went to the British Airways Heritage Center. Now, like you mentioned, I'm looking at civil aviation in general, so this means a lot of national archives, but I tried to look at the airlines themselves, and some of the airlines did keep corporate records I could look at, and British Airways holds on to the records for BOAC. And since I'm looking at the growth of transatlantic flight, BOAC was the big British airline that was flying across the North Atlantic. Now, they keep a lot of their stuff just next to Heathrow. Now, the place I was staying, unfortunately, was in North London, and Heathrow is way out in the west, so it was about 90-minute commute every day each way by subway and by shuttle bus to get to the place. But the actual archives are held in this gorgeous state-of-the-art museum, which is got to be like 5,000-6,000 square feet. And this is just their corporate museum. They bring employees in there, and they've got all kinds of models. They have working demos of the latest technology. They have, like, iris scanning technology for some of their new, security features. They got everything loaded up, gorgeous museum, and the research is done in a little kind of glass cubicle right off to the side. So I would go in there most days. I would sit down, but they don't really have the staff for museum and archives. They have the same guy who's in charge of the museum is in charge of the archives. So whenever I wanted to do any research, I had to flag him down, hope he was free, and the two of us would go down together, would track down the boxes I needed if we could find them, and then bring them back up, and I would look through them. And I found almost everything, but there was one or two boxes we were never quite able to track down. Their system, it needs a little bit more attention, I think. But we spent
the nicest way to say that.
They had almost everything, and it was almost all where we all expected it to be. But they had one guy who was in charge of all this stuff when they had stacks and stacks of shit.
It was almost where it was supposed to be.
Most of it was where it should have been. Most of it was. No, they had tons of stuff, and it was great, and I got some experience as an archivist for the first time in my life, which was kind of interesting to see how that side of our work goes, but it was definitely different having to go down and just, you know, pull the boxes, load up the cart myself, and come along, and I had great long chats with the guy. His name is Jim Davies, and he's the friendliest guy. It was interesting to get his perspective on flying across the Atlantic, you know, Canadian... the British side of things. And so, yeah, we had some great talks. It was just a really interesting place to be.
Now, you go down into the place to get these boxes. What does that room look like?
It looks like a gigantic storage locker,
yeah.
More or less. It's just rows and rows of shelves, steel shelves. The ceilings are a little over a story tall, and the shelves go nearly to the top. So if you wanted to get one of the higher-up boxes, there was a full-sized aluminum ladder that you would unfold, you'd climb up, you'd bring them down. Hopefully the boxes weren't too heavy so you could get them down. And the shelves themselves probably need to be replaced because they're made out of metal that I'm not quite sure it was designed to hold that much weight for that long because they were buckling a fair bit. Like, there's a lot of paper on those shelves. So it If England got earthquakes, it might be more of a problem for them, but I think they'll be okay for a while yet. But
because if there's an earthquake and these boxes fall, then most things wouldn't be where they're supposed to be.
It would be a bit of a chore putting everything back in order.
Yeah.
There's tens of thousands of folders in there, and there's a lot of good material. It would be a shame if it ever got out of order too badly.
Yeah. Something that's interesting is that so for your stuff, I remember we had to do a course 3 years ago now. Three years ago now. And we had to discuss our research proposals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you came in and you talked about doing the civil aviation stuff. And someone asked, well, where are your materials going to be? And I remember you said, well, you're going to have to go to Paris, London, and Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something like, yeah, I'll probably go to Paris and London in the spring, maybe in the summer. I'll probably head down to Miami January or February.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't repeat what was said to you after that because this is a family show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just remember thinking that you clearly picked... One, you picked a really interesting topic because I just find aviation really fascinating. And two, that's what you get to do. So you're like making vacations out of research.
Yeah. Something I would recommend if anybody has research that takes them out of town to think about what else you could do when you're in some of these places. Like, I went to London last summer partly because I had a relative I could stay with so I would save money, but partly because I knew she was out of town because the Olympics were in London that year and she wanted to get away from the crowds. So I got to see some of the events in person. Like, I just happened upon the women's marathon just wandering the streets one day.
What?
I just noticed there was a lot of crowds, and I was like, hey, I used to be able to cross that road. What are those barricades doing? So I walked up, and hey, I got some nice pictures. Yeah, it was a...
You didn't know what was going on?
No, I knew the Olympics were going on. I didn't know the women's marathon would be in that part of town right then. So I just, I climbed up some stairs. I got a couple of shots, so yeah.
Oh my God, that's the dumbest luck ever. Oh God! So, but you're not helping your case in this regard of the response that you got in that room 3 years ago.
No, I'm just saying that if it's at all possible that your research is going to take you someplace interesting, try to time it for something that might be worth seeing.
Yes, that's fair and that's legitimate, I suppose. Says the guy who went to Vancouver during the rainy season. I love Vancouver, but my timing probably was a little off on that one. All right, Sean Nicklin, appreciate you coming by.
Yeah, not a problem.
Thanks for doing it, bud.
Oh, not a problem.
Talk to you soon. All right, that was great.
That was awesome.
Sean Nicklin. We love Sean Nicklin.
Oh, Sean Nicklin's great.
Sean Nicklin's great. He needs to come by more often.
It was great to hear the story about being an archivist, an actual, that
literally
hands-on experience of being an archivist.
That's right.
That's great.
Yeah, most of us don't have the pleasure of...
It's like, it was funny, when you asked him that question of what it was like in the archives, mm-hmm. and he explained it as that... Basically, that big sterile room with just lots of storage shelves, that's what always comes to my mind.
Yeah.
And it just, I feel vindicated knowing that that's actually what most archives are like.
You kind of hope it, you want it to be more, don't you?
Well, yeah. I guess in your mind, you get this great idea. It's like, going down a secret elevator and then, you press in a couple buttons and the box gets retrieved from this labyrinth of boxes swirling around. But really, it's probably just that, where a guy goes down and picks up a box.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's not as romantic.
No, no. You want there to be something grand.
Yeah. I think I'm going to stick to my imagination on that one.
Yeah, it's more fun.
Yeah.
Before we go, you want one more story?
Hey, yeah, that sounds great.
All right, one more story. All right. It's another baseball story, because I just really like baseball. It's a Ted Williams story. Okay, now the way it's been told to me is a Ted Williams story. What's cool about this story is that it's been a number of players over the years who have been involved in this story. It's one of those myth type things that continues to get spread. But in the version of the story that I know is that Ted Williams is at bat and there's a rookie catcher behind the plate. First pitch comes in. It's a beautiful pitch right over the middle of the plate, belt high. Ted Williams doesn't swing and the umpire calls a ball. Catcher throws it back to the pitcher. Next pitch, same exact spot. Perfect. Pitch should be a strike, and the umpire calls a ball again. The catcher turns around to the umpire and he says, "Why aren't those strikes?" And the umpire looks at the catcher and goes, "Son, those pitches are strikes when Mr. Williams says they're strikes." And that's it. There you go. That's the lore of Ted Williams. If you want to say that it doesn't matter who you are in sports to get a call, that story just tells you everything.
There you go.
Yeah. So there you have it.
Beautiful.
Historical anecdotes.
I like it.
Now, feel free, if you're at a party, use any of these.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Right?
Yeah, talk about if you're a grad student or a historian of any time, obviously telling some funny or amusing archive stories is usually great, or obviously refer back to John A. MacDonald yep. or William Henry Harrison's unfortunate, untimely death
mm-hmm.
of pneumonia.
Yes, tough break. Tough break. And if you have any of your own that you want to share, you can throw them in the comments on Active History at the bottom of the post, or you can send them to me at the History Slam email address. And we can maybe even get a conversation, or you can tweet something out if you got something good. You can tweet it at me or at Active History. See what you got. I mean, I love this kind of stuff.
That'd be great. I'd love to hear what your listeners have to say. It'd be really great to hear other horror or awesome archive stories or their own personal favorite anecdotes.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe we can get a little discussion going.
That'd be great.
In this the last month of the year. This is the last podcast of the 2013 year, so my thanks to everyone for listening over the past year. We like putting this show together. It's a lot of fun, and hopefully you enjoy listening to it. So Aaron Boyce, thank you for co-hosting.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Anybody, questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is at Dr. Shawnee Fever. Have yourselves a healthy and a happy new year. We'll see you in 2014. And as always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.